I mean, that's Mike. We're not even we're lawyers here. We're not obviously in the room.
Son of the Judiciary Committee, will please come to order. Can you take the roll, please?
Sarah Eliason.
Here.
Sarah Josephson. Sarah Pettyjohn.
Here.
Sarah Ziegler.
Here.
Chairman Ray.
Here. There's a quorum present. First order of business is committee substitute for Senate Bill number 159, Judiciary, an act relating to assignment of district court judges and magistrates and providing for interpretation. Senator Ziegler, you're the subcommittee on the bill. Would you please give us your recommendations and whatever information you have, sir?
Well, very briefly, I see nothing wrong with the bill. It's just an obvious attempt to get around the Hornigan problem. The only time I ever even knew that we were in trouble with the bill was about 1 minute ago when I read the letter from Mr. Levy. And I hope he's here today because he kind of cast cold water upon the bill by his assertion that perhaps we have a constitutional problem. That's a letter of March 9th that is in the back of my folder.
Mr. Levy? Apparently he's talking about subsection C.
Yes, sir.
Presiding judge in the judicial district may assign this to the he is saying maybe a constitutional.
Yes, sir. That's all he says.
Article 4, Section 1 of the State Constitution provides the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court shall be the administrator of all courts and may assign judges from one court to the division thereof to another for temporary service. Is it an argument that we are not I would say that the key words are temporary service. Is it an argument we could define temporary service as not to exceed 90 days?
Yes.
Is that what we're doing?
Well, Mr. Chairman, off the cuff, if my brother Pettyjohn will allow me.
Please proceed.
I don't think that the legislature could define a term in the Constitution which would be contrary to the intent of the Constitution. So that if somebody had if there were some debates in the Constitutional Convention that considered this, that might indicate that temporary means a year, we couldn't overcome that. But if there is nothing to guide us as to what that means, I suppose we can define what temporary service means.
Looking at subsection C, we're talking about temporarily. So that would be a discretionary, that's the determination of what the Supreme Court judge said, his reasoning or his acknowledgement of temporary. And if he thought that temporary in his mind was more than 90 days, but couldn't he just reassign the guy 90 days?
I don't think so. It says, Mr. Chairman, for a period not to exceed 90 days annually.
I see.
So I would.
That would preclude that,
wouldn't
it? Yeah. Well, I bow to the legal minds within the committee. And
I always bow to them too.
I don't always believe them, but I would bow to their understanding. At least I would request that they assist the chair in making determination whether there is a constitutional problem or isn't. Mr. Levy was said that there may be.
I agree.
Do you agree?
I think there may be.
Mr. Chairman, the other element is that since it is the Alaska court which would determine whether there is a constitutional problem, and since the statute purports to limit the authority of the Alaska court, I dare say that he's right. There may be a problem. I mean, that's a real reality.
More likely than not.
I think, Mr. Chairman, the argument that the court would make, which very well could prevail, is that in determining the definition of terms which apply from the Constitution to the court system is the appropriate entity to say what those words mean. And I would not be surprised at all if this bill were to be ruled unconstitutional. I hesitate to...
Particularly when the judge is the guy we're talking to.
Yes, yes, precisely.
Is it worth the effort, and without loss of esteem, to pass it?
It's not your bill, Mr. Chairman.
Well, I don't have any, as I've often remarked, I don't have any pride in authorship. I do have sponsorship. I'm trying to eliminate the problem in any way possible, but if it is impossible, I want the people within that district to know that we made every effort to accommodate them. And if the judicial system believes that we have acted unconstitutional, that it should be within their purview, and certainly they should be the ones that state it and do it.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I feel we have a responsibility to, I feel I have a responsibility to examine anything I support with regard to its constitutionality. My responsibilities are in addition to the responsibilities others in other branches have. I feel that there's enough of a question here that I don't think I can support it.
If we eliminated on line 20 the words annually,
I'd still have the same objection.
Well, that's one, sir. Senator Joseph.
I think that would make it worse, because then it would seem that you could only do it one time in the judge's career or in the judge's term.
What are we trying to do?
Well, why doesn't, Mr. Chairman, why don't you explain to Senator Lyons on the original purpose of the bill and why it's before us?
We're talking about this this.
The situation and it's a uniquely a problem in that jurisdiction. I don't think it's a real problem anyplace else in the state. And so what you're doing is you're addressing a special
situation,
and every time you try to do that, you create more problems than you ever solve them, and that's just my experience.
It's up to the committee, of course. We're waiting on Mr. Levy. I don't see any value in what he's going to tell us other than the fact. I think he said perhaps all that he can say.
Mr. Chairman, there's also a lawsuit on this, I think, between Judge Hornaday and the court system.
There is?
Yeah. To determine whether the court has the authority it has exercised to move
the language.
Yeah. So he's testing that out right now.
Well, if there is a judicial determination in progress, then I would be the first one to say to hold.
Would you entertain a motion to hold the bill in abeyance until
sure.
such time as the court system
I
has
sure
resolved
would.
The current litigation?
I would be more than happy to.
Awesome.
Is there an objection to that?
No.
With all due deference to the sponsor of the bill, I understand.
I said, there's going to be any answer to that. next order of business we have is Senate Bill 147, relating to safeguarding self-identity and the address of motor vehicle operators involved in accidents. It is the intent, as I understand it. Are you Mr. Levy? Thank you for coming, but we don't need you any longer. More than happy to allow you to stay, but then...
Oh, that's okay, thank you.
Thanks for coming, though,
you
really.
Thank
silence
you for
is golden,
nothing. They say that you win them all without having to go to court, and I guess that's the best way it is. Getting back to Senate Bill 147, it's the intent of this is to eliminate or safeguard people from harassment when they are in an accident and the the other person in the that's involved with any accident creates a harassment, either coming to their house or calling on the telephone, and more or less to allow these people to identify themselves through a motor vehicle license number, their license on the car or the vehicle. That's the extent. Senator Joseph, you have the subcommittee on this. Do you care to continue?
I do. Well, I have some difficulty with this because I think that the information exchange is very helpful to the person whose vehicle is damaged or suffers bodily injury in filing actions, which is what the Commissioner of Public Safety says. However, he goes on to say, if the police or Division of Motor Vehicles have the data, I'm sure the injured party will be able to obtain a name and address from their attorney if they can afford to hire one.
I think from the information here on the letter from the Department of Public Safety, March 14th, in the second paragraph, if this bill were to pass, the person at fault or any other operator could legally refuse to provide any other driver or injured person with name and address information at the scene of the accident. They could state they will call the police and leave said information with the police agency. However, a large percentage of those who refuse to give their name and address at the scene would not call the police. Thus, the other driver or injured person would have a little recourse. But those who did call the police could create a burden on police agencies, etc. And this is signed by the commissioner.
See, a lot of these small accidents would not wind up really in a police file, a police investigation.
Fender benders.
And you'd be out
less
there.
Less than 500.
And the person would take off feeling that there was no obligation to report to you. What his name and address were, he'd be gone. I think it would create more hassles for the person whose vehicle is damaged than it would benefit. And I had not heard of the problem, of the security problem that is mentioned here, although I'm sure it does exist.
Well, it would appear to me that if a party to any of these proceedings were to wish to get the identity of the person, he could certainly get it from his own attorney. And the harassment could continue anyway, couldn't it?
Absolutely. Mr. Chairman, also...
I mean, you aren't denied the right... You're not denied giving the information to your client who struck him if he asked for it, right?
I think I could tell my client. And there's a lot of cases where, under this bill, a person would be forced to get an attorney when otherwise he wouldn't have to. That's there. You know, 40% or so of the vehicles don't have insurance in the state. If someone's driving a vehicle like that, doesn't have an insurance company that would be authorized to get the information, then he's got to go find a lawyer to do it, pay a lawyer, because he's got the information.
Name and address.
Yeah.
In other words, you're talking that this is a lawyer's semi-retirement measure.
Well, I wouldn't go quite that far, Mr. Chairman, but I think it would involve unnecessary attorney's fees for the public. It would, in fact, have that result. I feel that also, as pointed out in a memorandum here, that apparently the Division of Motor Vehicles takes the position that the name and address on a motor vehicle registration is public information. So that public information is available to whoever wants to go get it in any event. So what are we accomplishing?
But having the name of the registered owner does not answer who the driver was.
Not necessarily, true.
If you notice on the second page of the letter from the commissioner to the Senator Fisher, he said the Division of Motor Vehicles currently releases information from accident reports to participants. And I would think that there's no way that they can deny, if I'm in an accident and I say, who hit me, or who did I hit, and the police would investigate the accident, I'm certain it's public property that they would have to tell me who it was.
He may not know. He goes on to say, in situations where a person takes advantage of this bill and refuses to release his name to the injured party and the accident is investigated, the injured party must hire an attorney to obtain the information from an investigating agency or DMV and provide a written release authorization. In many cases, I think in the first paragraph where he says all motor vehicle traffic accidents are not investigated by the police, the difficulty is that the person who does not give you his name may also not file a report with DMV or the police department. And the only thing you would have is the license number, and you would not know the operator, and he would and there would be nobody with any duty to tell you who the owner was.
What with the stole license plate from somebody else?
Mr. Chairman,
yes.
We've got issue on the whole bill. It seems to me this reference to comments from Senator Pettyjohn and Senator Josephson, and I concur with what they're going to say, that this bill creates a host of problems, which are much greater than those problems which are going to cure.
Is it the feeling of the committee that the subcommittee should contact the prime sponsor and tell him what a lousy bill it is? And his
you tell him.
Well, that's with the chairman. As the chairman, I am going to delegate my authority to the vice chairman and have the vice chairman notify the sponsor that is he's got a cracker here. At least in your opinion, not necessarily the opinion of the entire committee, just in your opinion.
Your opinion of the chair.
Yeah,
not
of the chair.
Do you
want
to stand at ease while I go down the report?
No, I just would not do that either.
That's a good part of the bill.
I can tell him that you're waiting for his answer.
Then it is the feeling of the committee that we don't have a fool with this, right? We have three bills for a subcommittee assignment. Senate Bill 48, that is the chairman's bill, and I know all about that. We've been through state affairs with it, and we have a committee substitute presented by the Department of Personnel, one that was agreed to by both the State Affairs Committee and the Department of Personnel. And unless somebody is personally interested in it, I will assign that to myself, and it'll be up as soon as possible. Unless there's somebody else that has some interest in the bill, I'll assign that to myself. Senate Bill 271, relating to the exclusionary rule and changing Rule 412, Alaska Rules of Evidence. Senator Pettyjohn, you've been handling the exclusionary rules, so I would assign that one to you also.
Very well.
Senate Joint Resolution 3, sponsor Katua, proposing amendments to the Constitution of the State of Alaska relating to agricultural rights and state lands. I know this is an important part of the time for you, Senator Josephson. I understand that, being on the Finance Committee, and I would normally assign this to you, but knowing that you are very busy there, and Senator Pettyjohn has already been assigned the exclusionary, I'll assign this to myself for self-protection. Yes.
This bill has already been through resources just 3 days ago.
Fine. Then Senator Elias and I would assign that to you. Then, if you'd be prepared to bring me information, then possibly as early as Monday. Would you be prepared by then?
Ready.
Right. We also have two. We've been had referred to the committee two members for examination, two members, two appointments to the Alcoholic Beverage Control Board. I forget what the one gentleman said. Do you have that, Ray?
Mm-hmm. Wally Waters, the Red Holloway?
No. We have a John W. Walters from Nome. And we have his resume here, and unless the committee wishes this gentleman to appear in person, I will copy each member of the resume, and then if you're satisfied with what the resume holds, then we can proceed on that basis. If you're not, then majority of the committee desires or requires it, I can ask this gentleman to appear, but he lives quite a ways away. So, if you will, copy each member of the committee. The next person we have is E.L. Red Holloway.
Must be some mistake there, Mr. Chairman. No, I think he sells gas instead of liquor.
Well, Red used to be a member of the ABC board at one time.
There are at least three people around this table.
He lives here in Juneau, and it was a unless.
Mr. Chairman, I know Mr. Holloway, and I'm satisfied with his qualifications unless.
Senator Ziegler?
I'm just Senator Joseph, and I've known Red for 1,000 years.
Senator Elias?
I've known him at least that long.
I've known him
2,000 years.
2,000 years.
I feel left out.
Since he used to go around and try to get people to run against me.
I haven't had the pleasure of meeting the gentleman. I feel kind of left out. I'm certainly willing to go along with the committee.
Well, I'm certainly he can appear here, and it's whatever the committee desires.
I won't make that request, Mr. Chairman.
He was a member of the board for 2 or 3 years, I forget which. And he was not, I think he, when his term was out, he did not seek reappointment.
Did he do a good job? No, he didn't know.
Over the years, and when I had talked to him, and from talking to other people, Red did understand, and it'll be kind of a turnaround for him. When he was on the board, he was a industry member, and this time he will not be an industry member. So he'll have at least be able to go it from both sides. I think the gentleman is qualified, and I, of course, it, even approving of him doesn't mean that you're required to vote for him. That's just the name of him. So to make this formal, I would present to the committee the name of John W. Walters of Nome. Oh, no, you want to see his resume, I'm sorry. I will put the name of E.L. Red Holloway from Juneau to appointment to the Alcoholic Beverage Control Board. Expiration date, January 31st, 1986. Is there any objection to the man's qualifications or ability?
No.
All right, we'll write that up. Do you have any?
No, not necessarily.
And possibly the next meeting during the interim, and if possible, I will bring Mr. Walter's name up on Friday.
Is he an industry?
No. Senator Ziegler, you mentioned Wally Wallace, and I thought that he had been referred to. His name was somewhere in the mill. Did we ever get him referred to us?
Maybe it wasn't the ABC board, but I thought it'd been.
I thought it was too.
From Fairbanks?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I thought so too.
Would you check on that and check the appointment secretary on the in the governor's office?
Carol Durfner.
Is there any information? Is there any testimony or any questions from the public?
It's nice to have all these youngsters with us.
I was going to remark on that, but rather than to have it come from the chair, perhaps some of the members would like to express their appreciation to the young people who have sat so attentively and quietly. So I would.
Well, you're in good hands with the lady who's been taking you around here, Miss Ulmer, and it's good to see you here and just showing such an interest. If you have any serious questions, refer them to Senator Joseph.
Could you ask me, would you like to respond, Senator Joseph? Senator Joseph is the vice chairman of the committee, and when the chairman is not here, he is in charge.
I think it should be noted that we have three attorneys here, and the rest of the other two are just ordinary people.
Noted.
Layman, call you.
I would have done it the other way. We have two ordinary people and then there's the three attorneys.
We should have said three attorneys and two gentlemen.
Yeah. On behalf of the committee and through the TIC, Senator Joseph, do you have something?
Dick and I need to talk. Welcome to the Senate. Is there any questions that I need to have, please?
Fritz?
No, thanks for your attention. I'll stick around if anybody has any questions about anything. I'll be glad to talk to you.
Do you have any questions on capital punishment?
Nick? Or about the drinking age. We can talk about that now also.
Fritz will see you on the drinking
age. Nick? No, I just like to welcome them too, Juno. I know that they've traveled a long way to come down to see their government in action. I hope we haven't disappointed you.
All I can say is that for the last 2 or 3 hours, I've been studying a map of Alaska to see if I can pronounce the names right. I want to thank you for coming here. Thank you, ma'am. And with that, if there's no other business to come before the committee, we stand adjourned.
Yeah. Thank you. I'm good again.
Right.
I don't know. If you want to, you could jump up there, and I'll leave that to his discretion.
Anything to add, Bob, in view of recent developments?
No, Mr. Chairman. I think it's good discussion. Needed discussion.
I'll tell you. Senator Johnson and Senator Lyason get together on this thing and work out the amendment and a committee substitute for Monday, right? We'll bring it back up Monday.
All
right. Are you going to sit here with Senator
Lyason? I'm not going to sit here.
Are we?
We are now.
I got to play in the basketball.
So. Next order of business is the Senate Bill 127, an act relating to unlawful conduct of minors. I got you. Well, I know what I think about it, so listen to the testimony. Ms. Kleinoff? They want to, yeah, I don't have any objection if you want to wait.
Mr. Chairman, the department has been sent a new draft of proposed committee substitute anyway. I think it would be appropriate to let them sit on.
Ms. Horetsky?
Senator, if I may, I'd like to refer to Mr. Bryson following.
Then you'd like to wait until after somebody else says something. Oh, that's Michael. He's the right guy.
Thank you,
Senator. All right,
please.
Identify yourself, sir, and give whatever testimony you feel desirable.
Okay. My name is Mike Price. I'm the Director of Family and Children's Services. What I'd like to do is talk in a more general way about the need for a waiver bill. And,
sir, we know what the needs are for the waiver bill. And we're marking up this bill today, or we're going to consider it. And I appreciate the philosophical remarks, but we want testimony addressed directly to the bill and the provisions contained therein.
Okay, then I'd suggest that, the point...
Do you want Gail to sit up there with you?
Yeah, would you
come on,
what we'd like to do is let you know that the administration is interested in the waiver bill. We feel, however, that we'd like to suggest a different version of that bill. And we have a committee substitute available if you would allow us to...
Be more than happy to see it.
I think committee council has it.
You have copies of that?
Thank you.
You can't read them on your desk.
Yeah, what if we walk in with his desk?
Hmm?
You put up the walk in with his desk.
Looks like it's wrong. Is there another chair that you fit at your desk so that you just put it away? I want to go over there. Okay, we all have a proposal.
What we would be happy to do, if you'd like, would be to contrast the difference between the present bill that you have before you and the administration's proposal, however you would like it addressed here.
Senator, I'm prepared to certainly be interrupted by questions, but just briefly run down and compare the two versions of the bill.
Why don't you tell us the differences?
Yes, sir. Senate Bill 127 deals with juvenile waiver, among other things. The other things that Senate Bill 127 deals with are releasing of information regarding juvenile proceedings to victims or the parent and guardian of a victim. It also deals with the issue of liability of parents for malicious damage caused by their children. It also has a provision dealing with amending somewhat the law on emancipated minors. So to make it very clear from the outset, the proposed committee substitute, which you have in front of you, deals only with sections 1, 5, 6, and 7 of 127. In other words, in the administration's proposed committee substitute, we do not talk about emancipated minors, liability.
Why not?
Because we were trying to get together a waiver bill, and we anticipated that whatever else you wanted to add to the waiver bill would be up to the committee. So addressing the waiver issues, sections 1, 5, 6, and 7 of 127, what proposed CS for 127 does is create two classifications of waiver. The first one is an automatic waiver, sometimes called a legislative waiver. And the persons in this category who would be automatically waived to adult court are those persons under subsection 020A on the first page, persons 16 or 17 years of age or old, well, 16 or 17 years of age, who are charged with an unclassified felony. Unclassified felonies are murder in the first degree, murder in the second degree, kidnapping, sexual assault in the first degree, and misconduct involving controlled substances in the first degree. There are only five unclassified felonies, and those are the ones that I have just read to you.
What does that embrace? You mean that if someone is under the influence of cocaine, they have to be waived to?
No, sir. Misconduct involving controlled substances in the first degree is a very narrow classification of a drug offense. It's the most serious drug offense. It's an unclassified felony. It prohibits conduct such as an adult providing heroin to a juvenile, for example.
So this would be a juvenile maybe providing
There has to be a 3-year age difference before it's considered giving it to a juvenile. So if you have two 17-year-olds or two 18-year-olds, or 16-year-olds passing drugs back and forth, that's not included. But if you have a 17-year-old giving drug to a 6th grader or 7th grader, that would be included as an unclassified. And we'll get down a little bit later to how a person would be treated, but I'd just like to explain what the categories are at this point. The reason, sir, that is included is that it's an unclassified felony, and we have run into equal protection problems if you pick some crimes out of a category and address them a certain way and you don't do the other ones. That's why our bail statute was struck down by the Court of Appeals here not too long ago. So that's the concern for putting them all together. The second category of waivers are called discretionary waivers. They're akin to what we now have under current law, where under the current procedure, the DA goes in and says, Judge, we want to waive John Smith. The court hears all this evidence about whether or not, under the current law, John Smith is amenable to treatment, and then the court tries to decide whether he should be in adult court or juvenile court. That system has not worked very well, in the opinion of the criminal division of the Department of Law. It has been extremely difficult to waive people who needed to be waived, and on the other hand, some people, there's been a great deal of disparity. Some children have been waived because some individual judges are more willing to accept a waiver than others are. So under the discretionary waiver, you would have children of any age, which is the situation of the current law. There's no bottom limit, and they would be waivable for any felony offense. Under the current law, they're waivable for any offense, theoretically, even a misdemeanor. That's never happened to my knowledge. So this is confined to any felony offense. So it would include, for example, C felonies, B felonies, and A felonies. You could waive an armed robber discretionarily. You could waive a juvenile who has a history of 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 burglaries, which is not uncommon among juveniles, a certain class of juvenile offenders. These could all be waived if the court were convinced that it were appropriate. We'll talk about that standard in a second. Subsection C of that first section talks about once a person who has been waived to adult court and he's been convicted as an adult, sentenced as an adult, any subsequent offense he's considered to be an adult. This makes sense because any subsequent offense would probably be a violation of his probation anyway. There is one out for that, and that's if he's waived back to juvenile court, and that's in the next section. The next section talks about sentencing of minors. A person who is convicted either of the offense for which he was waived or of any lesser included offense will be sentenced as an adult, with one exception, and the exception is in section B. If a person is waived for an offense and is convicted of a lesser included offense, say he's waived for murder one and he's convicted of manslaughter. Manslaughter is an A felony. It's not an automatic waiver. It's a discretionary waiver. So if the convicted person chose to do so, following his conviction.
Plea bargain would not to be.
No, sir. He could petition the court to waive him back to juvenile court for disposition. It's up to the court whether to do it or not. The court could keep him as an adult if they wanted to, but they could waive him back if they thought it was appropriate to go in juvenile court. And I've set forth there 20 days written notice, the hearing. Burden of proof is on the convicted person, not on the state, and the factors to be considered are the same ones to be considered in a discretionary waiver to begin with. I'd like to emphasize that this does not apply to any unclassified felony. In other words, if a person was convicted, was sentenced, was waived for first-degree murder, was convicted of second. Second is an unclassified. He'd still be sentenced as an adult automatically. He wouldn't be eligible for waiver back. Sections 3, 4, 5, and 6 are merely housekeeping sections putting in exceptions which refer to a new Section J, which is in Section 7 of your bill at the top of the page. What that says is none of these people who are convicted as adults after being waived are subject to presumptive terms or mandatory minimum terms for their first offense. None of them. Even for murder, rape, robbery, none of them. For second time around, they are, and that's that Section 8. In other words, the court can give the offender the presumptive term if the court wants. There's nothing to stop the court from giving the maximum. The court's not required to give a presumptive term. It can take into account the youth, any mitigating factors, duress, coercion, fright, etc. But for the second time around, it is considered presumptive term as a second offense because the theory being you gave him his break the first time around, second time around, treat him as an adult.
Anybody can make a mistake theory. But if you couldn't learn the first time, you have to learn the hard way, that would say.
The theory is you give a guy the break the first time around. You may not, I mean, you certainly don't have to accept the theory, but that's the theory behind it. That's it. Section 9 is where, this talks about where these youths will go once they're indicted for the crime. If they are, they all start out in a juvenile facility, McLaughlin, for example, or the Johnson Center, for example. They all start out there. When they are automatically waived as an unclassified, they stay in McLaughlin until they're indicted, and then they go over to 6th and C or 3rd Avenue, wherever they're being held. If it's a discretionary waiver, then two things have to happen. One, he has to be waived by the court, and two, he also has to be indicted. So they're not moved into adult jails until both of those things happen. When both of those things happen, they are moved to adult jails, which I might add is the current system right now. Right now, when somebody's waived, they move them to an adult jail. If he is sentenced as an adult, he will be confined to the custody of DHSS for confinement in adult facility. Let me make clear to you that all of the classification procedures which now apply to any offender would be applied to these youthful offenders. So, for example, we would expect that the vast majority of them would go to places like Palmer or Eagle River, which is where the vast majority of your 19 and 20-year-old offenders go now if they're in there for the less serious crimes. They take age and possible vulnerability into account when people are classified to certain institutions and to certain programs. Other things are just housekeeping changes in the statute needed to comply with the new provisions. Perhaps the second most important section of the entire bill is Section 11, and that is the new waiver section. This waiver section applies to all discretionary waivers, and it applies to the waiver back if someone's convicted of a lesser included. What it says is you have to find two things. One, probable cause to believe he committed a felony, which it's now applies to any offense. And two, no substantial likelihood that the person could be successfully rehabilitated. The burden of proof is on the state. We must meet it by preponderance of the evidence. Those are the two things we must prove. The factors which the court shall consider are listed on the last page, and there are nine of them. And they include seriousness of the offense, the manner of the commission of the offense, the person's prior record, age, maturity, educational background, etc.
The biggest loophole there, Gail, is two.
But
there is no substantial likelihood. You can drive a truck through that.
Well, the current one is not amenable to treatment, which is even worse. This is an attempt to tighten the language.
I know, but geez.
Yeah, well, it's definitely a discretionary factor. I mean, it's a judment call, no question. That's what we pay the judges for.
Do you want me to bring up the guy that had 96 felonies over here and he was still walking the streets because he was a good boy? Just got in a little trouble now then.
I'd be the first to agree that the present juvenile system doesn't work very well for certain serious offenders.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I excuse me.
That's all right.
I
don't see that it's a big loophole, because on the last page you say, a finding that there is no substantial likelihood of successful rehabilitation of the person under children's court proceedings may be based on any one or a combination of the factors. And so therefore, I think you're saying that if the judge finds that there was a serious offense, or that the treatment resources available under the children's court proceedings, which is not the child's fault, as to their adequacy, are not going to work, any single one of those could be a predicate for finding that the that there is no likelihood of successful rehabilitation.
That's correct.
Well, that's not just opening up a little bit. That would, you would almost have a situation where, in a serious case per se, the judge would have the right to treat that.
Well, could, certainly could. It's up to him what weight he gives to the factors. See, that's true under current law. The problem is, under current law, the factors are not specified. The court can consider anything he wants, including the seriousness of the offense, if he wishes to do so, and can give it whatever weight he feels it's entitled. Problem is, he has unfettered discretion, and Judge A will waive people for drug offenses, and Judge B won't waive a multiple murderer. You don't have any guidance there. These factors have been drawn from the statutes of other states, and that language on any one or a combination of factors is word for word from another state statute. I forget which one now, but it's, I can look it up. It's an approach which is adopted and used right now in roughly 7 or 8 states, that exact language. And some of them are East Coast states and some of them are West Coast states. And what I did was research how their procedure worked now. And they seem to have more consistency, and they also were more willing to waive serious offenders than I have seen in our system here, which is why I chose that
way. Do they have safer streets? Do they have safer streets? I mean, why are we doing this? What's the public
The need for it is because under the current system, it is extremely difficult to waive serious offenders, and you get the situation where, for example, the FLA case, you have a person who bludgeons a man to death for money, and who spends 2.5 years in McLaughlin, and then all jurisdiction and control over his ends, and he's just walking around the streets out in the valley now, and he's not even on probation. Because the juvenile court is not geared up to handle that situation, at least in some applications. And there's the Shuey case in Ketchikan where he raped and murdered, I think it was an 8-year-old girl or a 9-year-old girl, and the judge refused to waive, and finally that went all the way to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court reversed it and sent it back. But those are the two most egregious cases that come to mind right off the top of my head as examples of why, for serious offenders, our system doesn't work.
Okay.
Well,
I mean, as to the explanation.
Yeah, reserving my right to object, and I will. We'll scrutinize this with the same care as the legislative ethics bill.
Well, it's all right with me, because I haven't read this. This is just all news to me.
I know. Gail's very articulate and talks very fast. Mr. Chairman,
sure.
May I ask Mike, you said this is the position of the administration. This represents a policy change which your department supports as well.
Yes.
I want to know if this is a voluntary or a mandatory appearance of yours.
No, we're, let me say that we sought this legislation in a prior year, and we sought it again this year.
It's also an answer to the public outrage, I believe.
Well, we have a different perspective on that.
Right.
And this is why I wanted to earlier talk about why we were seeking a waiver bill. And I want to emphasize that this is the administration's position, and that should the committee wish to adopt the substitute, we will have a formal position paper. But I do have the administration's position. This is the bill we would like to see, and there's a number of reasons for that, at least reasons that we that may differ from many views in the legislature. The administration's position is that a strengthened waiver provision dealing with delinquent use is desirable for 3 reasons: to better protect the public from a small number of violent and dangerous youth offenders; 2, to impose greater societal sanctions on this group of offenders; and 3, to allow for a more appropriate treatment modality under the adult correctional system. I'd like to point out that the present youth services system is generally effective. And the exception, however, is the violent youth offender, those who commit generally unclassified felonies. And those have been listed. These youths are presently housed at the McLaughlin Youth Center and what we call the Closed Creek Unit. Our population there is between 11 and 13, and we have approximately 5 murderers in that unit right now, and 3 to 4 rapists. It's our belief that the youth services system is not appropriate for these youths because they're not like most of the other youths in our system for a number of reasons here. First, they've committed a very violent crime generally. Two, that the age, sophistication, maturity of these of this group is very much different. And three, that there is a need for greater control and more a lengthy period of incarceration, as well as the need for an adult system of classification and treatment. Let me say here that our concern is that many of the youths that we have, they might come in at 16 or 17, and they may be there for a year or 2 years before they literally leave the system. We don't think that that is a long enough period for many of these youths, that there needs to be a longer period of treatment, if treatment is needed. And the maximum presently is up to age 20. So that so these youths, these 5 youths, are gonna leave the system at age 20. And some of them should not be on the streets. That's what we're saying.
Is it my understanding, Mike, right at this time, that a 17-year-old that is convicted of a felony, and he goes to McLaughlin, to what age is he in there?
Up to age 20.
Up to age 20, if he consents to stay there.
That's correct, but I want to emphasize that we haven't had anybody who hasn't consented.
And where does the guy 19 go?
Well,
goes home.
The present system requires their assent, or consent, from age 19.
You have to be 21 before you end up in living care.
No, you can be there 19, earlier.
18.
19 or 18 when you go there?
18 or older.
Right.
That's if you're waived, right?
Well, if you're waived, you go to Lemon Creek. If you commit a crime when you're 19, when you're 18 or older, you go to Lemon Creek.
Right.
It goes by the date, how old he was when he committed the crime.
Right. But then you have 18-year-olds that might be in Lemon Creek, and you have 20-year-olds that might be in McLaughlin.
That's right.
Precisely, and that's
can't have that.
That's the point we're making here. And
that's what I was trying to. I was getting confused there, and I couldn't get it straight in my mind what you're talking about.
Okay, and
Friday's along. You know, that's the end of the week. You know.
Right about that.
Okay. And we'd like to talk about, you know, who is this group? And I'd like to give you some national statistics to put this in perspective. Is that the we'd like to emphasize that through the statistics provided by the National Crime Victimization Survey 1981, U.S. Department of Justice. They indicate that juvenile crime is less serious than adult crime in 3 ways. One, that juveniles commit less violent crimes than adults. Two, that the results of the crime lead to less personal injury. And three, less property loss is usually occurs. So it's erroneous to conclude that juvenile crime is more serious or more frequent. However, the National Institute of Juvenile Justice, what we call the Wolfgang Report, they followed juvenile offenders since 1958 and have followed this group for a number of years, and these are their conclusions. This is their most recent conclusions. That a small number of young offenders is responsible for a disproportionate number of total crimes, particularly serious and violent crimes. Rather than implementing a get-tough policy in all youth, what needs to be done is to identify small numbers of violent youth and to deal with them differentially.
Yeah, but
okay, now,
but Mike, what's the percentage more of 65-year-old people who commit crimes and 19-year-olds? Just take those 2 years and compare them. I mean, stats don't mean anything, really.
Well,
unless you want to use them to make a point.
Yeah. Well, I think what it does is give us some perspective here. What we're saying is that, yes, youth do commit crime, but but generally they're significantly different than the adult crimes, and that's why there's a need for a juvenile system. However, we also point out that there is a certain group of youth offenders that the juvenile system or the youth services system isn't really designed to handle. And that's the point we're trying to make here. Now, I'd like to give you some statistics for Alaska to bring it home, is that in 1981, which is our last complete year for statistics, we had some 6,128 total arrests. Of that group, some 2,047 were what we call criminal, non-criminal arrests, or status offenders. That is, those are the youths who were drinking, who were out past the curfew, and so on. Now, out of this remaining approximately 4,000, some 648 were actually adjudicated by the courts. And the courts ordered some 95 of this group placed in a secure youth services institution. Also, out of the 648, some 60 were arrested for unclassified and Class A felonies. We found that 11 of the 95 were placed in McLaughlin. Now, what we're saying is that out of this huge group of youths that committed offenses, that only a small number in the judgment of the courts needed to be, were found guilty and needed to be placed in youth facilities because of the nature of their crimes. Now, really among this group, only 11 were what we would call serious offenders. And what we're really talking about here...
You know, when we had the other bill come up, the Department of Corrections bill, I stated that I was personally open to tightening the waiver law, and I am. And I think that the matter of people being discharged from custody because they reach a certain age is outrageous. I think we should change that. Well, I don't understand why we're making it so complicated, though, with mandatory groupings. Why not take, going to page, section 11 of your bill, this is the Josephson version, and keep section 11 as you've got it, except, and this is what I would do.